It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Farage. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, scientific research shows that high expectations can lead to increased performance. It's called the Pygmalion effect. We'll learn about that and some other cool stories from the world of science with Gemma Tarlak from Discover Magazine.
First, two trains derailed in Wisconsin over the weekend, and each accident led to leakages and the evacuation of the surrounding communities.
A train carrying ethanol derailed on Saturday in Alma and spilled ethanol into the Mississippi River. And then on Sunday, a train derailed in Watertown, leaking crude oil and causing the evacuation of 35 homes.
Crews are still cleaning up the spills and trying to figure out the causes behind the derailments.
For more on these stories and the issue of rail safety in general, we're joined by Marcus Stern, an investigative reporter who's covered the risks of transporting oil by rail. Marcus, thanks for joining us today.
It's a pleasure. Thanks, Rob.
Well, when you hear of a derailment like this, what kind of things do investigators look for to try to figure out why this happened?
Well, if there are injuries, the NTSB, the National Transportation Safety Board, will send crews to take a look. I don't think they will in this case. And otherwise, the railroads will probably do the primary investigation. And they're going to be concerned about primarily it's a public relations issue for them. They really need to try and keep down the publicity as much as possible. You know, with these two derailments, I think there's good news. The good news is that neither one exploded. I mean, with the ethanol, there was a fatal ethanol train derailment in 2009 that put this risk on the map. And there was one in 2013 with oil trains that killed 47 people. So the fact that there was no explosion is good. What we don't know is we don't know if these tankers that are involved are the legacy tankers. Are called legacy tankers because they have a lot of flaws. They shouldn't be used for this kind of, for the transportation of flammable fuel. Or are they the newer tankers that the railroads have been creating to make these tankers safer to carry the oil in? So we don't know if it's the older tankers or the new tankers. We also don't know the volatility of the oil because in the last year, North Dakota has started conditioning the oil to make it less volatile, and we're still waiting to see if that's going to help. And the fact that there was an oil spill here but not an explosion was a good thing.
You mentioned that that fatal explosion that killed over 40 people, that was in Canada. You wrote, and a lot of other people hoped, that that would be some kind of wake-up call that would help us get a more secure oil-by-rail transit system in place. Have we seen a lot of movement in that direction?
Well, when you talk about this risk, there's three or four key elements to it. One is the tankers themselves, and there's been a lot of work done to try and make those tankers more robust, and they'll be phased over the next 6 years. But we really have to see how that works out. We have to see if these tankers continue to rupture the way they have been in their older models. And then there's the issue of volatility. We need to see if the volatility of conditioning the oil will make it less likely to explode. We have the question of rail infrastructure and operations. You know, one of the leading causes of derailments is just track failure. And that's on the railroads, particularly. They really are responsible for making sure the tracks are in good shape. And then the last thing is emergency response, but there's not really much emergency responders can do in a case like this other than evacuate a half mile in every direction from where the fire is or the spill is or the derailment.
Talking to investigative reporter Marcus Stern about the safety risks involved in transporting oil by rail after two derailments here in Wisconsin, one carrying ethanol, one carrying oil. That was this weekend. Marcus, let's start with that last point you raised first, the issue of emergency responders, first responders. There's been controversy about how much information they are getting from railroad companies about what and where and when these substances are being transported through communities.
There has been a real struggle to get the information from the railroads. The railroads don't mind giving it to the emergency responders, but they don't want the emergency responders to be making the information public. And I think part of that, again, comes back to the PR issues for the railroads. They really don't like to publicize the fact that they're moving an explosive product in rail cars, questionable rail cars, through communities. And they really don't want to make it clear how much is moving how often. So there has been a real struggle that hasn't been completely resolved yet. Hopefully the emergency responders will know, but it remains to be seen whether the public will know.
And you mentioned the volatility issue a couple times. There's oil, it sounds like, and then there's oil. What is it about that North Dakota oil that makes it potentially a more hazardous in the case of a derailment?
Yeah. It used to be when we all thought of oil, we thought of that black gooey stuff that we saw in the Beverly Hillbillies, program. And it's not, it was from Texas. In the last 7 or 8 years, they've been pulling a great deal of oil from deep beneath this ground in North Dakota. It's a light oil, it's a shale oil, and it's much more like gasoline. It's more volatile when it comes out of the ground. It has what are called natural gas liquids, a lot of propane, ethane, butane, which need to be at least partially stripped out to make it safe to transport. But really, neither the federal governments or the railroads or the oil industry really know really what the proper chemical composition is to make it safe. They don't know how much of these natural gas liquids need to be stripped out.
Economic incentive, Mark, because it sounds like, to not strip out so much of it. If you can ship it as close to intact as possible, you can get money from extracting that at the end, maybe down on the Gulf Coast. So companies have an incentive to not remove those more volatile compounds.
That's absolutely right. If they separate them out in North Dakota at the wellhead, the natural gas, the propane and the ethane and the butane just get either vented or flared, and their value is lost, and they create pollution. If they put them into the rail car, it becomes ever more dangerous. But if they can get those natural gas liquids to the refineries along the Gulf Coast, the East Coast, or the West Coast, those refineries can then process the oil, take those natural gas liquids, and sell them even overseas, which is something they can't do with the oil itself.
Now, Senator Tammy Baldwin from Wisconsin has been pushing for rail safety reforms, a plan I believe passed the Senate but wasn't taken up in the House of Representatives. What kind of changes are people looking for at the federal level related to the issues we've been talking about?
Well, I think they're looking for the federal government to do something on the volatility issue. The federal government itself spent almost 2 years looking at this issue, and it had issued several safety alerts, emergency orders that related to volatility. But after 2 years of cogitating, it issued a final rule over the summer, and the word volatility didn't even appear in it. So they basically punted on that question of volatility. Now, the state of North Dakota itself has set a sort of a threshold that it wants the oil to be conditioned to a certain point. But oil with that level of volatility has exploded, has burned. So we don't know that that's really low enough. So I think people want to see the federal government actually set a standard for volatility. I think that a lot of folks are really concerned about the fact that the sturdier rail cars are going to take so long to be phased in. It's going to be several years. And I think that there's been a real focus on bridge safety. And there in Milwaukee, you have in Milwaukee, there's a bridge that is very rusted and had signs of real deterioration. It was corroded to the point where some of the steel in the beams was missing. And local officials and Senator Baldwin tried to get the railroad there to prove that the bridge was safe and that it had indeed been inspected by the railroad. And the railroad steadfastly refused to allow anybody to see the inspection reports or records. So I think that was a source of great frustration. So I think that one of the things that people are pushing for right now is an inventory of rail bridges and some kind of database that allows folks to look and see what kind of maintenance and repairs have been done on that bridge.
Marcus, thanks a lot for joining us today.
It's been a pleasure.
That was investigative reporter Marcus Stern talking about the risks of shipping oil by rail in the wake of two train derailments in Wisconsin this last weekend.
facial recognition software has been used by police departments and counterterrorism agents for years, but now it's starting to creep into our everyday lives.
Gemma Tarlak joins us now for a look at that and other stories from the worlds of science and technology. She's senior associate editor at Discover Magazine based in Waukesha. She joins us each month at this time. Gemma, welcome back.
Happy science to you both.
Well, how does this facial recognition software work nowadays?
Well, in a lot of different ways. It's really interesting the strides they've making. And this is quite frankly a case where the development of the technology is really outpacing kind of how we've decided legally and culturally to deal with this technology. And right now, facial recognition, you know, for years, mugshots, passport photos, good lighting, straight-on shot, computers are great, and they have been for years, at recognizing people in those conditions. But now they're developing special new types of deep learning techniques so that they can pick up someone if it's a very dark photo or a blurry photo or their face is mostly turned away. The computers are learning to recognize those faces, and this is a huge leap forward, technologically speaking.
Now, you said that we haven't quite figured out how we're going to use it and when it's allowed, but how available is this technology to the public right now?
Well, it's not just one monolithic technology. There are a lot of different algorithms, a lot of different ways of doing the facial recognition. And, you know, law enforcement has a lot of techniques. I would say they're the most advanced, and they're growing all the time, and they're expanding the number of databases and the levels of law enforcement, you know, county, state, federal, international, that have access to that. But if you think about it, you know, if you're on Facebook, you are dealing with facial recognition already in your life, because Facebook and Google and a number of other social media applications have various ways of, you know, whether it's tagging someone and saying, hey, yeah, this is my friend so-and-so, or just even recognizing someone. And I have to say, I don't know about you two, but if you're shoplifters, yeah, facial recognition is being used by stores now to identify shoplifters, so watch out.
And not just shoplifters, but maybe this could be used for shoppers, period. Hey, we've got this face profile, and now we've got these cameras in stores. Rob, we saw you've been lingering by snack cakes, so we're going to send you a coupon for those. Is that the present or the near future?
Yeah, that is one of the very creepy potentials that, and you know, it depends how you want to define it, whether that particular technology is actually here or just around the corner. There was an app called NameTag that had ways of, you know, you snap a photo of someone, or let's say you walk into the store and the store's camera takes a photo of you and can run you against the database and identify your name and occupation and address. There are those kinds of applications. They're not widespread, and some of them, quite frankly, have not really been tested in a real-world setting, but certainly the technology is increasingly out there and it's increasingly available. So it could be happening, and really, there are only a couple states that have any kind of laws on the books about how to deal with this kind of technology.
Right. It sounds like the ethical questions are still to be answered, and maybe even the questions themselves are being formulated. So what are the big questions that we have to think about?
Well, I think the really big question is, how are we going to use this technology? You know, the writer in our story makes a terrific point that technologies are famously neutral, and it's really we, the people using them, who decide whether to use them for good or ill. Would it be great to identify a terrorist through facial recognition software before he or she did something really horrific? Absolutely. But can that same technology be used to identify, you know, Rob, you walking into a store and suddenly having your cell phone go off with a special coupon for your favorite brand of whatever? So we really need to have attention working it out. And it's kind of interesting that attempts to figure out how to do this have been really shaky, because businesses are like, yeah, I want to be able to take a picture of someone and send them a special coupon for their favorite product. And there's a lot of pushback from a lot of different corners. So it's really a huge to be decided.
Talking to Gemma Tarlak from Discover Magazine, our monthly look at the most intriguing stories from the world of science and technology. Let's move on to another one, Gemma. The Pygmalion effect. I remember the play and the musical based thereon. But what is it? What is Pygmalion in the world of science?
Well, this goes back to an experiment that happened about 51 years ago, where a academic came into a classroom, actually a whole school, and administered what he said was a special test. And this test identified particular students who were going to bloom that year academically. And he came back at the end of the year and found, wow, the students that took this test and the specific ones that he said, yes, they bloomed, they actually did much better, and they were, you know, quote-unquote blooming. Then the teachers who were teaching these students all along found out that the whole thing was a bit of a farce. It was just a basic IQ test that he had administered, and he picked children completely at random to tell them, to tell their teachers, oh, these kids are going to bloom. And it was actually the teachers knowing that subconsciously, they had higher expectations for those children, and that in turn led to the children doing better. And it's called the Pygmalion effect, and it's actually been seen in a number of areas since he identified it in 1964. The problem is it only works if it's subconscious. You know, like if you're in on it and you know that it's just a totally random thing that higher expectations have been assigned to this person, not because they show signs of being, you know, more academically clever, what have you, but just because they've been picked at random, if you actually know they've been picked at random, it will not work. But if it's subconscious, the teacher, whether it's through nonverbal cues or other means, has higher expectations and the child performs better. It's one of those crazy things that science just goes, huh?
Yeah, it's, I mean, it's fascinating results there, but how do you actually put that to work in real life for good? I mean, on the one hand, it also seems sort of
ethically
for those kids who didn't get the stamp of approval, that might have been a painful year.
Exactly, exactly. And, you know, one of the things is they can't really tinker around by repeating the test and trying to replicate the results. They can't do that now because, yes, there are serious ethical concerns now. But one of the things they're looking into now is, you know, I mentioned nonverbal cues, nonverbal communication, and it's amazing the amount of information we convey without saying a word, whether it's the tilt of our head, the raise of our eyebrows. And so they're now actually training teachers to be thinking about that nonverbal communication and to really be putting out sort of more positive nonverbal communication. Because, you know, if you think a child is going to do great, maybe you give them a facial expression subconsciously that encourages them. And, you know, the opposite is true, too. If you've kind of unfortunately written a child off, maybe you're going to express that nonverbally through your facial expressions, your body language. So now they're training teachers to sort of have higher expectations and express them nonverbally. And it's a really interesting science. The jury's not in, because this part of the program is really new, but wouldn't it be great if we could just help children by increasing our expectations of them in a way that, you know, just nonverbally, just a tilt of the head? Wow. Wouldn't it be great if we could do that?
And are people trying to do this now in classrooms?
Yeah, yeah, they're training teachers in classrooms, and there are a few different programs out there and taking a few different approaches, but they're actually starting to do this, and as I said, it's a little too early to have concrete results, but the preliminary results are pretty positive.
We're going to wrap up right now talking about lava.
Who knew there was a hot topic?
Oh. Sorry, Gemma. That was Rob for
you. I love the lava.
So tell us, there's a lot of crazy stuff about lava that we didn't know. What's at the top of your list?
Oh, my gosh. My favorite kind of lava. It's just this banana stuff from, it's one spot in Tanzania. I can't pronounce this word. Oldonyolengai. It's this volcano that has this black natural carbonatite lava that is still very fluid at a, you know, respectively low temperature, just 1,000 degrees Fahrenheit, and it turns this beautiful silver color. It's like something from Lord of the Rings when you see photos of this place, and I just think, wow, that is so attractive. I would love to have a fountain of that in the middle of my room as a centerpiece.
Except for having, you know, molten lava and the temperatures and the safety risks, I imagine.
Oh, details.
So I didn't think of it. I mean, I guess lava is going to vary depending on the mineral composition of where it's coming up from. It never occurred to me.
Yeah, the mineral composition, the temperature, and there are so many other factors. In fact, the most common kind of lava, basaltic, thankfully, is kind of the least dangerous. Other types of lava, including andesitic and rhyolitic, they have a lot more gas, actually, it trapped inside. So, you know, when they blow up, whew, they blow up. You know what I'm saying? So it's kind of good that basaltic is the most common, I think.
And lava isn't just relegated to planet Earth. It sounds like it's a fairly active thing on other planets.
Absolutely. Whether you look at our own solar system, you know, Mars has the tallest mountain in our solar system that we know of. It's called Olympus Mons, and it's really just an enormous basaltic volcano. So you've got that on Mars. You've got, you know, there are some moons of Jupiter and such that are just like basically full of lava that erupts in these massive curtains that are just hundreds of miles long. And it's absolutely fascinating. And some of the exoplanets that we're finding just appear to be like great balls of lava.
And briefly, Gemma, as we wrap up, a lava here on Earth could have played a role in the extinction of dinosaurs.
Yes, yes. You know, we all know about that giant asteroid that slammed kind of more or less into Cancun about 66 million years ago. Well, it looks like when the asteroid slammed into Cancun, it kind of really rattled the planet, and it set off monstrous, monstrous flows of lava in India, in what's now India. It's called the Deccan Traps, and it looks like that huge explosion may have also released enough poisonous gas that killed poor T-Rex and all those other dinos.
Wow. Well, Gemma, cool stuff. I mean, hot stuff. Sorry. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Always fun. Thank you.
That was Gemma Tarlak, Senior Associate Editor at Discover Magazine, based in Waukesha. She joins us once a month to talk about the coolest science news.
And every Monday in December at this time, we'll break down the science stories of the year from Discover Magazine's Year in Science issue. We'll kick that off on Monday, December 7th. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Recent years have seen increased awareness of the issue of human trafficking, especially as it relates to women and children being forced into the sex trade.
But our next guest says it's critical to deal differently with those who are coerced into prostitution and those who chose to work in commercial sex, and that more people have chosen to be sex workers than we might think.
In addition, she says that keeping prostitution illegal makes it less safe for the women and men in the trade, and that the billions of dollars spent to arrest sex workers and their clients could be redirected to more serious criminal activities.
Joining us now is Allison Bath. She's an assistant professor of journalism at West Virginia University and was a longtime medical and science writer for the Boston Globe. Her most recent book is Getting Screwed, Sex Workers and the Law. Allison, thanks for joining us today.
Good to be with you.
Well, we have a picture of a sex work of prostitution that that has been front and center lately. I think that it's sex trafficking. It's human slavery. Most sex workers are coerced, maybe trafficked across state or international borders. You say that happens, but that's not the norm. That's not even the majority.
That's right. The most of the men and women who are doing sex work today are in it by choice. They are doing it for economic reasons, to pay their way through school, pay down student loans, have the flexibility to raise families. For instance, there's a study that was done by the Urban Justice Institute in New York that found that only 16% of the people doing sex work in New York City say they got into it by being trafficked or coerced into it.
Let's talk about law enforcement then. You make the case, this is one of the key points of your book, that the way we enforce prostitution laws in this country makes sex workers less safe, considerably less safe than if it were decriminalized. Can you make that case?
Well, basically, what happens when sex work is illegal, violent predators can operate with impunity and prey on both sex workers and women who are not sex workers. Sex workers are like canaries in the coal mine when it comes to violent predators, but because they often see them first, men who rape and kill women. But because they are afraid of being arrested, they don't go to the police because they are afraid they're going to get arrested themselves. So these serial killers and other violent predators can operate with impunity. So you see, for instance, with the case of Gary Ridgway, the infamous Green River killer, who was accused of killing upwards of 49 women in the Washington State area. Several sex workers knew that he was the killer. They'd either survived or they'd heard about it. And they were either afraid to go to the police, or when a few did go to the police, they were ignored and not listened to. So he went on and killed others. And as I said before, when these kind of violent predators are allowed to operate with impunity in the community, non-prostitutes are killed as well.
And apart from that worst case, really, the serial killer, you write that sex workers, prostitutes are in danger, sometimes from their clients, sometimes from corrupt police officers. How does that play out in a criminalized world of prostitution?
Well, unfortunately, like every profession, there are a few bad apples, and sometimes there have been cases where police have insisted on free sex in exchange for not arresting a sex worker. It happens more than we'd like to believe. And in other cases, I tell the story of Jennifer Reed, who was a young single mother working as an erotic dancer in Ohio, and a corrupt police officer pressured her for sex, and when she refused to give him free sex, he harassed her and her family and made life very difficult for them. So bad laws lead to bad cops, and unfortunately, if it were decriminalized, sex workers would be much more feel more comfortable going to police and working with them to report either abusive pimps, violent clients, or killers.
We're talking to Allison Bass about her new book. It's called Getting Screwed, Sex Workers and the Law. Let's get into this concept of decriminalization. Amnesty International, their international branch, recommended to their national branches that this could be an issue for them, should be an issue for them. Feels like, I thought, a fresh new argument, but actually in your book you write, we had this debate in the 70s, not the 1970s, the 1870s.
Oh, that's correct. The American Medical Association came out in favor of decriminalizing and regulating sex work from a public health and public safety standpoint. So what happens is when in countries where sex work has been decriminalized and regulated, sex workers have more time to negotiate safe sex, i.e. sex with condoms. And in places where it is illegal, often those transactions are rushed. So in countries where sex work has been legalized, like the Netherlands and New Zealand, there are very low rates of HIV and other sexually transmitted diseases. And in fact, in Rhode Island, which for 30 years, because of a loophole in the law, indoor sex work was permissible, incidents of rape and sexually transmitted diseases went down in that state.
But a lot of people look at this issue, and this is from feminists maybe on the left to religious conservatives on the right, and say there's something inherently exploitative, degrading about the exchange of money for sexual acts. Is there something to that?
Well, I'm sure for some people sex work is degrading, but for many of the men and women who do it, they find it empowering. They like what they do. And what happens when there's been entrenched attitudes against prostitution for centuries, and it comes out of this idea that we have to venerate marriage and make it somehow different from the institution, an institution which resembles it, which is sex work. If you think about it, marriage is an implicit exchange. You get sex in return for certain things, and sex work is a more explicit exchange. So for centuries, church groups needed to put marriage on a pedestal because that was where you had reproduction and offspring, and they needed to vilify sex work. And you add to that the layer of sexism in that women are not supposed to enjoy sex with multiple partners, and you have these entrenched attitudes about sex work. If you think about it, there are almost as many male sex workers in this country as there are female sex workers, and yet female sex workers are 4 to 5 times more likely to get arrested.
I want to look at a couple of international models, different ways of dealing with enforcement. One attitude, and I've seen this some in the United States, is, all right, we're not going to arrest the sex workers themselves. We're going to go after the clients, arrest the Johns, put the impetus on them. And I think Sweden, you write, is one country that's done that. You're not a fan of that approach. Why not?
No, because that actually makes working conditions much more dangerous for sex workers. And it has not curbed the number of women doing sex work, nor has it led to a decline in sex trafficking in that region. All it does is because clients are afraid of getting arrested, they rush the transaction. And again, sex workers can't negotiate safe sex, and they are forced into more hidden, isolated spaces. So since Sweden passed this law, it's actually become more dangerous for sex workers to operate.
A country you offer as a more positive example is New Zealand. Can you talk about how they have changed things there?
Well, in 2003, they decriminalized laws against adult prostitution, leaving in place laws against child prostitution and trafficking. And at the same time, they regulate venues where sex work happens, like brothels, massage parlors, spas. They regulate them like any other business, so they're licensed and they are inspected regularly. So if when the inspector goes in, if they find that there are labor abuses, labor exploitation, or that there's, for instance, an illegal immigrant that's being employed in one of the brothels, they can shut them down. So the local municipalities regulate these places and determine where they're going to be and how many they want. So they may not want them near playgrounds and schools. But at the same token, they don't require sex workers to register with the state, because there is still so much social stigma to doing sex work that that would just push men and women into the illegal sector. So they regulate the facilitators of prostitution, and it has worked very well in improving working conditions and reducing violence against all women, and also reducing the spread of HIV.
We're talking with Allison Bass about her new book. It's called Getting Screwed, Sex Workers and the Law.
And we want to hear from you. Would you support decriminalization of prostitution? Have you or has someone you know worked in the sex industry? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post a question or comment on the Central Time Facebook page. We're continuing our conversation with Allison Bass. She's the author of the book Getting Screwed, Sex Workers and the Law.
And we want to hear from you. Do you think that the resources spent on arresting prostitutes or their customers is the right priority? If not, where would you rather see the money and time spent? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post a question or a comment on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll go to a caller now. We've got Judith on the line in Wausau. Judith, hi.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I would say that I'm actually in favor of legitimizing prostitution, and I definitely think it would perhaps do a lot to diminish the sexual slavery aspect. But I had really called for a point of information from Ms. Bass, if I could. And that is, when she talks about the near 50-50 split between female sex workers and male sex workers, I am curious to know, the male sex workers, are their customers predominantly women or men?
Judith, thanks for the call. And you do get into that in your book, Allison.
Yes, they're predominantly men. I'm talking about gay escorts who serve male gays. Population, and there are many of them because there are many men who haven't been able to come out of the closet and have their sexual needs met, so they turn to gay escorts, and there are many of them operating throughout the country. And when you try to close down sites like websites like Rent Boy, as law enforcement did recently, you just make it more difficult for sex workers to operate safely. You force the lower end of the scale out onto the street, which is a much more dangerous venue in which to operate to sell sex.
Judith, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. And you write about the gay male escorts themselves. Oftentimes, their family might not accept their sexual orientation, or they can't come out to the family. Often they're runaways, and they don't have a lot of other options, as I understand it.
That's right. Both teenage runaways, both girls and boys, often they're running away from homes where they've been molested and abused themselves, or they're lesbian and gay, and they haven't been made to feel welcome, and they're running away from very unpleasant home situations, and they're selling sex for survival on the streets. What these young men and women need are not getting arrested and re-traumatized by the criminal justice system. What they need, and where we should be putting our resources, is into social services, into education, housing, support, and counseling for these young people so that they can choose to practice a different lifestyle.
Seems like part of what you're trying to do in your book is to complicate our image of who is doing sex work in this country. Legally, we take, it sounds like, a one-size-fits-all approach.
That's very true. There are many, a growing number of middle-class men and women who are doing sex work, as I said before, for economic reasons, to pay their way through school, pay off expensive student loans, and raise families. One male escort I met at a conference, Legendary Dave, was a single parent who was raising a child, and he was an escort, and he did what we call out calls. He met his clients in another apartment and kept it separate from his home life, but this is the way that he could raise his child, and his child is now in college, and Dave is considering retiring.
Talking to Allison Bass, author of the book Getting Screwed, Sex Workers and the Law. Still time for your call at 800-642-1234. Should prostitution be decriminalized? Why or why not? 800-642-1234. Allison, I started off the interview talking about sex trafficking, especially maybe of underage girls and boys, I suppose. It's not, you say, the majority of sex work in the United States, but it does exist. What would be the right legal approach to solving that?
Well, what does exist are, again, these teenage runaways who are largely operating in their own communities. So the word trafficking is a very confusing name because they're not being transported across borders for sex work. They are often operating in their own homes. See, by definition, anybody under the age of 18 is considered a trafficking victim, even though they may not consider themselves as such. The other problem with the push towards sex trafficking is that, again, the majority of illegal immigrants who do sex work in this country are not being forced or coerced into it. They are doing it by choice. However, there are some that are doing that are trafficked in terms of illegal immigrants. And as I said before, what we need are we need to put the money for the teenage runaways into social services to help them with education, housing, so they don't have to sell sex for survival on the streets, okay? So they can get out of the sway of abusive pimps, although the majority of them are not under the sway of abusive pimps, according to a big study that was done in New York City. As far as women who are being trafficked, they need to have social services as well. What happens is that they're not supposed to be arrested and they're not supposed to be deported, but they are routinely deported, so very few of them are going to go to the police and say, look, I'm being trafficked, because they don't want to be deported. So the problem is that the way our law enforcement is enforcing laws is actually exacerbating the situation and pushing true victims of trafficking further underground.
You, as part of your research for this book, talked to a number of women who are working as sex workers, and it sounds like, as you mentioned, a lot of them do it in lean times, and eventually they move on and get married or get other jobs outside of sex work. Is that a pretty common life story?
That's right. A lot of young women who do sex work may go into it for economic reasons for a few years. For instance, I talked to Anna, who worked in one of the legal brothels in Nevada. Nevada is the only state in the nation that currently allows some form of legal prostitution in brothels located in its rural counties. And Anna had lost her job. She was married, and she lost her job during the Great Recession. And so she decided to work for a brothel with her husband's complete support. She had expensive student loans to pay down. So she worked in the brothel for 4 years, paid down her student loans, and put her husband through graduate school. And she is now no longer working in the brothel. They're back in Florida, where she is raising a family, and her husband is working.
We'll go back to our callers. We've got Ann on the line in Madison. Ann, hi.
Hi. I think that I'm somewhat repeating a previous caller's, or that somehow the author has already spoken to this. But as a psychotherapist, I am just aware that this business of the people are doing it by choice is not completely true. At least in many circumstances, the people have been abused as children and have this attitude that I'm going to get pushed around sexually. So if I can take command of it and get something out of it myself, all the better. It comes from an attitude of resignation, almost.
And thanks for that call. Did you find that people who were in sex work had been sexually abused, Allison?
Well, among street workers, yes, there's a greater percentage of women who've been sexually abused as children. But among higher class or higher end escorts who are doing indoor sex work, there wasn't a greater percentage who have been abused as children.
And thanks for that call. You're making the case in your book for decriminalization of sex work in the United States and elsewhere. Do you see this being something that the politicians, the legislators who would have to sign off on this could get behind?
Well, I think it's going to be an uphill battle. But if you look at who would have thought that we would be legalizing marijuana and same-sex marriage 15 or 20 years ago. So I'm hoping that eventually we'll be able to change attitudes and show people the public health benefits of decriminalizing sex work. I realize it'll be an uphill battle. But recently, a Washington, D.C. city councilman, David Grosso, called for the decriminalization of sex work in that city because of the public health reasons.
Allison, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
We've been talking to Allison Bass. She is an assistant professor of journalism at West Virginia University, previously a longtime journalist. We've been talking about her most recent book. It's called Getting Screwed, Sex Workers and the Law. You can still share your thoughts on the conversation, your opinions, and the idea of decriminalizing sex work, prostitution. Head over to the Central Time Facebook page and let us know what you think. Today is the anniversary of Carl Sagan's birthday. He would have been 81 years old today.
Carl Sagan was an astronomer, an astrophysicist, a cosmologist, or put another way, he was a guy who made us think really hard about our place in the universe on what he called the pale blue dot, planet Earth.
Sagan wrote an essay called Pale Blue Dot that referenced a picture of Earth from way, way out in space by the Voyager 1 space probe in 1990. Here's Sagan reading the ending.
It has been said that astronomy is a humbling and character-building experience. There is perhaps no better demonstration of the folly of human conceits than this distant image of our tiny world. To me, it underscores our responsibility to deal more kindly with one another and to preserve and cherish the pale blue dot, the only home we've ever known.
A lot of deep thoughts there by Carl Sagan. And Rob, you remember the TV show Cosmos.
I do. I remember I got to stay up past bedtime to watch Cosmos. So you didn't always get to stay up late to watch TV, but it was educational. Cosmos fit the bill. Yeah, and I had let my own kids stay up late to watch Neil deGrasse Tyson's Cosmos.
Right, same here. That one's a great one. The lineage keeps on going. And I also saw, do you remember the movie Contact? That was based on
his
one
book.
Of Sagan's, one of his short novels.
I got to go back and watch that. I've never seen it.
It's
Jodie Foster.
Yep, Jodie Foster. One of those mind-bending, are we alone kinds of stories.
Stick around. There's more to come here on Central Time on the Ideas Network.